would party politics work in the Isle of Man? Lord Daniel Finkelstein thinks that on the one hand it might, and yet on the other hand it might be no better than what we've got. Mitch Sorby, on the other hand, seems keen to establish his new political party, Isle of Man First, which at first glance would substantially reduce government income, while being rather vague on how expenditure reduction would be delivered. We'll hear from Lord Finkelstein later in the programme, but first, Christian Jones talks to Mitch Sorby.
Every decision in government, I think, they should look at putting the Isle of Man first. Whether it's something they personally agree with or not, it has to be the first thing for the island, for its residents, for its businesses, and for the people that live and work here.
What was the moment that made you decide to launch the party? Was there a tipping point?
Well, I've always been fairly vocal over COVID at lack of support for the bars and the restaurants on island, where we were forced to close down for a period of time without any real support. Our staff were supported, which was excellent, but the actual businesses themselves, and there's a lot of businesses out there still carrying legacy debt. So I follow these very, very closely, and obviously I'm very active within our own restaurant side and our licensed trade. And I look at the government as totally out of touch with the trials and tribulations. I know people, the catchword is, well, support hospitality. Hospitality doesn't need any support. What it does need is the government to stop taking so much from it. That way it can support itself.
And looking more at the party, do you have candidates in mind already? What constituencies will you be standing in?
Well, the goal is to field a candidate for every single constituency. That's the goal, to do what needs to be done, I think, personally. And the sort of the common view is we need to have a majority in Timwell. And that's obviously 12, 13 people. Because, being brutally honest with you, one person can't do anything. I think I said this with a previous interview. Every 4 or 5 years, I come champing at your door and say, I promised you this, that, and the next thing, and you say, yeah, you did, Mitch, and that's the reason why I voted for you, but you've done nothing. You turn around and say, as well, I'm so sorry, I'm one of 24. I couldn't get anyone else in behind me, so therefore I'm really sorry, but I've let you down. And you think, well, that's very true. Okay, I'll vote. And I've said this many times before. What's the definition of insanity? Simple. It's doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. And unless we have a huge paradigm shift on island at the next year's elections and we vote in a similar style, it might be different people, but 24 individuals will be like sitting in a canoe, paddling in all different directions. There is no clear direction, and that's what I'm trying to do with Isle of Man First, is to get a focus, to get people together that want to make this island a fantastic place to live and work.
And we'll turn to kind of political and party accountability. That's something which has been on many people's minds recently. What would it take for you to remove the whip from a sitting MHK that's part of Isle of Man First? Is that something you would be willing to do?
I would say yes. There's a draft manifesto there. This is the first stab. This will evolve over the next few months with the common consensus of other people. It will evolve, but at the end of the day, The key to it is we have to have a laser focus to get things done. And if people want to step out with the laser focus, then they can no longer be part of the party. And I think it is clear. What I don't want to see is 24 people jumping on the bandwagon. And then once they've got in under the auspice of the party, is to decide, no, I really don't want to do this. I want to go on my own. I've got my own agenda here. That won't be allowed.
Well, let's turn to some of the detail, because obviously promises are one thing, delivering is another. We'll start with tax allowance in your draft manifesto. The headline pledge is to raise the personal tax allowance to £20,000 in your first 100 days. Have you costed that?
There has been costings done on what that would cost.
And what have you got?
There is an outline on there. I'm not going to go into too much detail at the moment for the simple reason all the detail I go into at the moment will probably be nicked by one of the current MHKs. to try and do something similar so that they can buy themselves back into power for another 5 years. So I don't really want to go into that in detail. All you need to know is it has been costed. It will work.
Because I've costed it, and it comes out to about £50 million drop in government revenue straight away. Where are you anticipating plugging that gap?
Well, what you look at is, if we're talking about government revenue, we've got a GDP on Ireland last year reported at £5.6 billion. But you get government costs of £500 million. I don't know any sustainable Western society that can take 10% of the GDP to run government.
But looking further ahead, your ambition is £50,000 allowance.
Correct.
Which would be a loss of about...
Well, 42,500 if it's accurate. And the reason for the 42,500 came from is that's the average earnings on Ireland.
That again, would bring a loss of about £250 million.
Again, it's keeping it's efficiencies. It's looking at the efficiencies that can be created. It's maximising what we can do on Ireland. And really, there's a lot of things that are currently being done that can be changed. And there is significant savings can be made.
Because you suggested that higher earners above £150,000 a year would pay more. But would you agree that's a very small slice of the population that do earn more than £150,000?
Yeah, I think it's a small slice. But if the way things are going at the moment, you'll probably find that it won't be long before there'll be a lot more people earning that sort of money.
But that wouldn't save £50 to £250 million worth of... extra revenue.
It won't, but again, it harps back to the original thing of the efficiency. I don't have a crystal ball what's going to be happening in 5 years' time. This is a goal of that I would like to achieve. Certainly with, you look at the minimum or living wage that they're talking about at the moment, that's gone up some 30% in the last few years. Our actual allowances have gone up a couple of £100, pennies. And if this government or any subsequent government they're spouting off, they're trying to bring people out of poverty, they're trying to give, they're not, all they're doing is lining their own pockets, because for every pound that they can force onto a business, they're effectively getting 50 pence of that pound. So it has nothing at all to do, because what happens then is prices go up, they get more VAT as well, so they're getting 20% of this increased price as well. I think now people are starting to switch on to the fact that these minimum living wages are nothing more than a tax grab. And what I'm trying to do is give people actually money back in their pockets, because what do people do when they have money in their pockets? They spend. It's basic economics 101. If you have the money in your pockets, you go and spend, your economy grows, everyone has the feel-good factor, and that's what I'm trying to achieve.
But then to pay for services, the government does need money to be able to do that.
Correct, but the government has to be efficient.
Okay, well, we'll turn to housing, because you've set out a tenant purchase scheme which lets long-term public sector tenants buy their homes at a discount. That gives government a one-off receipt but will remove rental income forever. Is that not just stripping assets without any lasting revenue stream?
No, because what you're then going to do is you're going to ring-fence that money for the sole properties. And you're going to build new properties. You're going to build efficient properties, energy efficient. You're going to build new properties for new people to go in. One of the key problems Ireland has, and I see a lot of going away parties. I listen to a lot of people. I talk to probably 1,000 people a week in my business. And on that, what people are saying is they can no longer afford to live in Ireland. They don't have the roots down. They're renting a property and they really want to be able to put roots down, but they don't want to rent. So they go back across the UK or they go wherever they want to go. And what I'm trying to do with that, and I think it, I saw a huge difference where I was brought up in Alexandria, just next to Loch Lomond. We had a council estate, of two or three of them up in Bon Hill. And you would never dream of getting anywhere near that as a kid in your bicycle, because it would have been taken from you. The grass was up to probably waist height. I'm sure you had fridges, bodies lying in there. No one really cared. And then when they had the right to buy their properties, what did people do? They bought their properties at a big discount. Next thing you notice, they're investing in windows, new windows. They're investing in better insulation. They're investing in kitchens. They're investing in bathrooms. There's a feel-good factor. They're now looking after their properties because it's theirs. And they actually, the whole vibe of that area changed very, very significantly with that. All I'm wanting to do on Ireland is give people that have been long-term tenants the opportunity. They don't have to buy the property. They can stay as a renting if they want, but they have the opportunity to have a discounted property, and they may want to invest in that.
But obviously you said that sales will be ring-fenced to build new homes, but we know the planning system's slow, land is scarce, and construction is expensive. So in the meantime, are you not just reducing the housing stock?
No, as I say, this isn't going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen one day. It's going to be, but we need to get legislation in place that we can actually put that together.
Okay, so you're going to be introducing new legislation to
do... There will be legislation to allow people to buy their own properties, yes. Okay. I think that's key. People will then put roots down on the island. They want to stay here, they want to live here, they want to make the island prosper, as I do, and that's every inch of my being wants this little island to be probably one of the most prosperous in Europe.
And how does Isle of Man First feel about dilapidated properties, those that have fallen into disrepair, not paying rates?
Well, I think that's kind of unfair. You need to look at the reason why it's dilapidated properties. There's, for example, the one just along the road from me in North Quay. It's a dilapidated property. And I think the person has actually tried to get planning permission to regenerate that. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, the planners have knocked it back. I think that has to then go to an appeals board, and not an appeals board that's based in the UK, as I understand a lot of the appeals thing, and they look at the black and white appeal. What they need to do is have a local appeal to say, is it better for the island? And that harks back to Isle of Man First. Is it good for the island? If it is, we do it. If it's not, we don't.
Okay, we'll move on to healthcare, because your promise is to substantially lift pay for NHS staff, improve digital systems, shorter waiting lists, better outcomes. But as we've covered, if you're taking large chunks out of government revenue, how are you going to be paying for those?
You're taking large chunks out of revenue, as you've said. Saying that, you said you're increasing efficiency. And if you're increasing efficiency, I said this earlier on, coming from a business background, when you do a rationalisation or you're trying to make something more efficient, you might have a one-off hit for that year where maybe people are wanting to change roles or whatever, or moving into a different department, or you've got the set-up cost of a department. You don't know if that's an ongoing basis. That's not efficiency. That's just empire building.
Every politician talks about cutting waste, cutting bureaucracy to fund improvements. But Manx Care has been tasked with drawing up efficiencies plans. Are you saying that they're not trying hard enough?
I would say where there's a will, there's a way, and there's not a will at the moment to do it.
Where would the efficiencies come from?
Across the board.
But where specifically?
Specifically, as I said before, the issue I have is I can only get so much information through the Freedom of Information Act. There's a lot of doors are closed, and you have to make assumptions. And rather than blow my mouth off and make an assumption which is wrong, I would rather say the current structure is too bloated. There is not enough people. There's too many chiefs and not enough Indians. And at the end of the day, it's the Indians that look after the people that are unwell, the doctors, etc., etc. These are the frontline staff that make, what's the best way of putting this, that can shorten the waiting times when you're waiting in A&E. And, you know, these are the people we need to look after. These are the people we need to encourage to the island. And this is what we need to do. We don't need another manager. We don't need another pen pusher. We don't need another paper shuffler.
The Sovereign Wealth Fund is meant to be fueled by natural resource revenues, particularly from gas, but you will be aware that Tim Walz has voted to restrict any further licences. Is your plan not already blocked unless you can first persuade Tim Walz to reverse that decision?
Again, it depends if you have the control of Tim Walz. So if it's good for the island, we do it. If it's not, regardless of what people think, we don't do it.
So if you do have control of Tim Walz, and you've got a majority in the House of Keys, you will be looking to revoke that so that new gas licences can be issued.
We'll look at the situation there. We'll take expert advice if the gas is feasible, if it's achievable. I'm not a pie-in-the-sky person. I need to make sure that things are accurate. And there are experts out there. We just don't seem to speak to them. We make decisions based on gut feel, but there are experts out there.
Okay, but how would you respond to people who say, well, there might be a contradiction there, because on one hand you're saying we're this pragmatic, forward-thinking, innovative party, but then on the other hand, your flagship fund is only possible with the use of fossil fuels, which many countries are looking to move away from?
Well, I think you'll find a lot more of them are coming back to fossil fuels now. I think that the green agenda, whilst it's utopia, it's nice to have, and I'm a great one for saving the environment. I'm a great wildlife person as well. But at the end of the day, we have to be realistic. If you've got China building a new coal power station every week, then Isle of Man deciding it's not going to do something, it's not going to make any difference.
Final thought. You've put through this draft manifesto. Would you describe this as a wish list manifesto? Because there are a lot of popular headlines in here, but do you accept that you will have to make hard choices and trade-offs?
I think if we get the right candidates with the right will, we can make this happen.
That was Mitch Sorby. Next, Daniel Finkelstein.
I was lucky enough to be given a tour of Tynwald, which was completely fascinating. If, like me, you are interested in how politics works, to talk about, which I did with the president of Tynwald, he was very kind to give me his time, to talk about how the House of Keys works with 24 people, with obviously a ministerial group that can't be more than half, but you still have to assemble all of that. And we talked about, you know, what happens, which I know has been a sort of fairly recent event, what happens when someone resigns, how do you deal with collective responsibility? What do you do about scandals? And the fascinating question, how do you maintain independence rather than party positions? So for anybody who's interested, as I am, in the kind of mathematics of politics, when you start talking about politics with small groups like that, it's really, really interesting. So I was completely riveted by it. Really, really real privilege.
And you're no stranger to politics. You were obviously an advisor to Sir John Major. The UK has a very defined party politics system. But obviously, like you said, the Isle of Man has almost no party politics. What are your thoughts on a parliamentary system where there is almost no party political influence?
Well, it's fascinating. And in some ways, obviously, it's the ideal because you get greater independence. If you were to look in a mathematical way at how politics works, the one thing you wouldn't want to do is to say to people, one, you all have to agree with each other, and two, you must never admit your mistakes, right? And that's those are the two organising principles of much of party politics. You've got to agree with everyone else and never admit your mistakes. Whereas if you were trying to organise something that was optimal for decision making, you would always admit your mistakes, and also you would use all the diversity of opinion to create a collective wisdom. So yours is a much better system. And the only reason that you're able to work that is because, you know, 1,600 votes is enough to get a front row seat. And so you can know your voters and you can be more constituency orientated rather than party orientated. In a British political system, the problem is that there are so many voters, you can't do that. When I ran for Parliament, ran a couple of times, I realised that physically, if I divided up the amount of time it took me to go to each door, I simply couldn't visit every member of the electorate and talk to them in a way that you would like to in order to be their representative and persuade them that you should be allowed to do that. Because I couldn't do that, you have to give them broad gauge messages, and then of course you need to organise yourself in the form of parties in order just to give people a few simple messages and get them across on television, because, you know, there's a limited bandwidth. I guess social media may give back that possibility of connecting individual politicians with individual electors. It's at least possible. It doesn't seem to be going that way, does it? It does seem to be encouraging everybody to kind of go in behind everyone else, and maybe that's just a human capability. But I was really impressed by that sense of independence and reliance on constituency that you have here, and, you know, long may it last.
We do have a tricameral system as well. Do you think that works for getting things done in a timely manner?
Well, look, when people say they don't like to have politicians, obviously what everyone would really like to do is, my father used to have a joke. He used to say the best committee is a committee with two people on it and the other person can't come, right? And I think that's what most people think, which is the best political decisions are ones I make for myself. But that's not representative of the diversity of view. So you can't have that. And if you don't have that, unless everybody's going to be busy all the time on politics, you need politicians. I've actually got this in a fairly direct way. I'm a member of the House of Lords. And the House of Lords, it's not a house of politicians. People are supposed to have and do have other roles. And some people are retired and they can spend all their time on it. Other people like me are not retired. And often when there are important matters coming up in the House of Lords, I find that I've got a meeting of something else that somebody's paying me to do. And I need to be at that. I realise that you can't expect every person in the country to be directly engaged with what your policy is going to be. You need to have politicians. So I don't think, you know, with a house of 24 people and then, having nine effectively in LegCo, you've got too many people for doing that job, because you need an intermediary between people who've got to get on with their lives and people who are working in Parliament who can really focus in on the issues. I remember once going to my brother-in-law, I'd help William Hague, whom I worked with, on Prime Minister's Questions, and I said to my brother-in-law, "Did you watch Tony Blair's response?" And he went, "No, I was working," because, he's in advertising. And I laughed because, of course, in my little micro world, everyone was like working for the leader of the opposition and watching Prime Minister's Questions. And that's not what they do. They're getting on with their lives. So you need politicians. If you don't have politicians, what are the choice? One, people making direct decisions for themselves on issues they haven't got time to consider properly or the expertise. The other alternative is you have one person and you don't elect them. If you're not going to have either of those, and I think people can immediately see that neither of them will be desirable, you're going to have elected politicians. So people can complain about having too many politicians or who the politicians are, but they also have to think, well, it takes a certain mindset to want to be a politician, and you'd actually need that mindset. People need to, for example, we were talking about, and he was saying, oh, politicians are just always trying to please people. And I said, well, that's really what you're paying for. They are trying to please the electorate as well as represent their own principles and views, because and you need people who've got skills in doing that. And that is a particular skill set. And interestingly, when you watch someone who isn't particularly skilled at doing it, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, of Keir Starmer, who's a very clever man and also a nice person, and I think, in my experience, ethical, certainly intelligent, but he's not very good at politics. And actually everyone who most of them complains about political skills and politicians trying to do things in interviews, when it's not there, everyone thinks, oh, it'd be better if he was a bit more politically skilled.
Let's talk about some of your other job. You said that you're a member of the House of Lords. Obviously, you were the executive editor of the Times for a period too. What do you feel is the future for newspapers?
Of course, you can say there's a real challenge to newspapers now. And we provide people with two things, okay? One is we provide them with content, news content of the type that you're brilliantly conveying, live Daniel Finkelstein interview to your listeners. Lucky them. We provide them with content. And the other thing, which, as you're aware, we provide, is editing, right? So it's edited content. It's not just content. So let's say when I was comment editor of the Times, somebody who's a rabbi would send me an article on ethics. And I would read that article, decide whether it was something that Times readers would want to know, written in a way that they would find comprehensible, and make a decision about running it. And sometimes I would run it, and sometimes I wouldn't run it. A free media would just publish it anyway and make you read it and make that decision. So what we're doing, edited content, means I've read it. I think this is true, reasonable, intelligent. And I think there is a need for that. But clearly, we'll be challenged on both those things. So first of all, there's a huge amount of content. It's much easier to create content, and people can convey that content using social media channels. And secondly, AI will provide people with editing tools, so they'll be able to home in on the things that they want, build their own algorithms about the news feeds that they want. And maybe they'll make good choices. Maybe sometimes they'll cut out too much serendipity with too much calculation, but they'll do it, it'll work reasonably well. So it's a challenge to both things that we charge people for. The Times charges people for content, it charges people for editing, and both of those things are under challenge. But I think there are a number of ways in which we're helped. First of all, it's a lot easier for us to gather that content. Secondly, we no longer have to print it all on very expensive pieces of paper. Right? Used to be said, don't argue with people who order ink by the barrel, right? Which was talk about newspaper proprietors. And I remember talking to Rupert Murdoch about how him saying to me, the price of ink is a big, big factor in whether this paper is profitable or not. Right. And obviously, if you cut that out, the costs of the paper are easier to control, and also it's a lot cheaper, so you can reach more people. And we've also got those AI tools to use ourselves. But finally, and the most important, I think there is a market for the authenticity and accuracy that only human intervention can guarantee. What people want is not only to have something true presented to them, but they want to know that it's true. And they want the reassurance that they're dealing with professionals who are making that judgment. And I think the Times, if you look at the history of the Times, in my view, there's never been a moment where we are providing people with so much accurate and broad content.
That was Lord Daniel Finkelstein. Thanks to Christian Jones for this week's interviews. So what did you think? Is it sufficient to rely on the phrase, where there's a will, there's a way? And did Lord Finkelstein think party politics is a good thing or a bad thing? I think he's left it for you to decide. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now, I'm Phil Gawne. Goramayo. Thanks for listening.